Welcome to the second edition of the Business of Collaboration podcast. In this podcast, we try and answer the following questions. What is innovation? How do people collaborate and work together? Who is behind the most innovative ideas, technology, and knowledge? We are curious about people. How do they innovate? How do they create a new technology or acquire new knowledge? We give them a voice and a platform to share their stories because they are superheroes.
This is your host, Jara Pascual, founder of NoCo and CollabWith. Today, we have the pleasure to talk to Marcus Benznes, founder partner and senior consultant and ticker, and committee member of the work group of the ISO Innovation Management, and business developer and consultant at Norsk Spade in Norway. This podcast, Business of Collaboration, is in collaboration with ISPIN and is all about the ISO standard for innovation management and how to build creativity in a team. Do you want to know? Listen to our podcast with Marcus Benznes. Marcus, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much, Jara.
Thank you very much for your time, and as well to come to talk about the innovation standard, the ISO. You are working in the work group. So now I have a question for you, because we want to know you better. How did you found the Thinker? What was the trigger for you to create your company?
So at the time, I was living in Tromsø, the city where I grew up. And I had a work situation where a lot of my work was directed towards creative processes. I was working a lot with the arts, with small and medium businesses to innovate and rethink the way they approach the challenges and also their offerings. And I had this growing interest, as I said, in creativity, and I was put in contact with a man named Christian Wengen, who also on his side in Vadsø, a lot further east in the northern part of Norway, had been diving deeper and deeper into the field of creativity, looking at research, different models and methods, and trying to come up with new ways to approach it. And he had this idea of maybe starting some kind of company that could specialize in creativity in some way. And we had been working on similar projects or in tangent with each other before, so we knew about each other, and we were put in touch about to talk about this agenda, and quickly discovered that we had sort of very common interests and very closely connected perspectives when it came to creativity and kind of the lack of a more structured and systematic approach to creativity in businesses and organizations. And in terms of the trigger, I think fundamentally we had this notion or this experience really that there was this huge gap between what we knew about creativity from scientific research, from best practices, and from experiences in organizations, and what was predominantly happening in organizations across size, geography, culture, you name it. I mean, most organizations just had very little clue about what they were doing when they were working creatively or trying to work creatively. So, I mean, we saw that there was this role to play. We could form a company that could form a bridge, really, between the knowledge, the know-how, the methods and practices, and the organizations who were, continually asking questions. How can we work better in the field of creativity? How can we get more return on the resources that we invest in the creative process and innovation? So back in 2014, we really started the company as more of an experiment or an experimental project, trying to do some action research into organizations where we tried out different methods that were more so than perhaps the most common methods, based very concretely on scientific research. And long story short, through a couple of these action research projects and also through some other client engagements, we were able to prove, I guess, that the business really had a raison d'être. There was a room for a player like this, a bridge builder between the world of scientific knowledge about creativity from fields like psychology and sociology, and these organizations and their need to work more structured and more systematically with creativity and innovation.
Do you have an example of how you apply this to real companies, to the SMEs or to corporates? How do you help them?
Sure. So in the beginning, what we did was we really tried to look at the methods and processes, really the practices in the organization we were working with. We tried to put them into perspective using literature on creativity. So for instance, the way that creative meetings were being facilitated using brainstorming sessions were for the most part in contrarian to what research actually showed. So creativity research shows that if you want to have the most, the highest number of ideas and the best possible ideas, you should actually start by working individually on developing ideas and then share ideas and go into these sort of more group formats of sharing ideas. Because if you start sharing ideas immediately in a group, you very quickly move into group thinking and you kind of set the stage or the scope of the process by sharing these first ideas. So that's just one very specific example of how we use research to change practice that is easy to understand. Mm-hmm. Now, the company has certainly evolved, and the work we do now really spanned from doing trainings in innovation and creativity methodologies to taking lead roles in innovation projects, especially with small and medium enterprises, to building innovation management systems and creating organizational designs for big corporations and big public and humanitarian organizations so that they can better innovate in a more reliable manner across the portfolio of projects that they have. So I guess, one example that is a bit more specific comes from the work that we've been doing in the humanitarian sector, where we both have trained innovation managers in the field to better facilitate workshops and help develop solutions for sanitation, for individual rights, stuff like that, to the largest level where we're currently working with the Red Cross on a huge scaling project where we're studying how scaling happens in the humanitarian sector using the Red Cross organization as a case. But we're really working on the overarching structures of how they do their innovation work.
So what is the work you are most proud of?
Oh, that's a very good question, Aaron. I think two things come to mind. The first thing is really what I related to what I just mentioned, because a couple of years ago, we did a grand audit of the innovation capacities or capabilities of the four largest humanitarian organizations in Norway. And the work was in part commissioned by a project funded by the Norwegian government. And it really set out to both help improve these organizations in their designs, in their capacity, their competency with regard to innovation, but also to start formulating new models for how innovation could work in the sector. And some of the impact of the project was certainly very tangible right after or even over the course of the project. But perhaps more importantly, we really feel that we were able to, adapt some of the most crucial truths about innovation to a humanitarian context. Whether it's about, the ISO standard or leading research on the topic, most of the research tends to be about corporations, the commercial sector, private companies, startups, scale-ups. But if you want these ideas and if you want innovation more generally to actually work in a sector like the humanitarian sector, you have to take into consideration the preconditions that govern how innovation can actually happen in that sector. So for instance, you don't really have a client or a market if you're in the humanitarian sector. The people are paying for the services you're delivering, are really the donors, right? They are not the ones who are receiving the services. That would be the beneficiaries in their lingo.
Yeah.
So, you know, dynamics like this makes it necessary to change or adopt or really revise and rethink how you approach innovation in a systemic matter for that sector. And the work we did on these audits helped propel that work forward and really established a common lingo and a common framework for these organizations to better approach innovation and also to better share best practices, ideas, experiences across the organizations, because now they have a common framework, a common language to describe what they're doing when they're working in innovation. And in all humility, I really think that these organizations, before the work we did with them started, you know, I'm not taking full credit for this development, but still, there is a significant difference in the way that they approach innovation and how effectively they do so. And I'm tempted to attribute at least, you know, a significant portion of that to the work that we did. The second thing that comes to mind is something completely different, and it's perhaps more interesting on a personal note or a personal level. And that's a work that I did in 2015, 2016, where we took a model that we developed in Tinker, a process model really for the creative process, drawing upon you know, the different models in leading research, and we tried to apply that to the creative arts sector. So we talked with some leading artists in northern Norway and mapped their creative process onto this scientifically founded process model. And I just thought it was hugely interesting to see how, you know, the way that creative artists across domains, so, you know, musicians, filmmakers, painters, actors, dancers, you name it, I mean, they all have creative processes that is very much in alignment with what leading research on creativity prescribes, or describes rather, as the best way to approach creative processes. And moreover, the project, I mean, because moving on from that mapping, we also took some of the tools and principles that emerged from this analysis, and we turned it into process tools that could be generalized and made universally accessible for other companies. So we tried them out in, you know, a couple of workshops where we worked with people in the financial sector, we worked with designers, we worked with manufacturing companies, and we saw that the practices and principles that dancers use to develop performances actually has merit. They're valuable for organizations way outside of the sector as well.
Yeah, and, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And for me, proving, you know, that these ways of working from the creative arts actually had such an importance across other domains was really satisfying for me, because, you know, I kind of come from that sector as myself as well. And you know, really achieving some degree of elevation with regard to the importance of the mental models that exists in the creative arts sectors. So elevating the importance of these mental models really for other domains and professions felt really important and valuable to me. So that's something I'm proud of.
I remember now this week I was watching in Netflix, there is a documentary about creativity.
Oh.
Yeah, it's 1 hour film about where it's coming from, the creativity, and how the creative people, they are getting these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite interesting to see, like, this match making between research, we can say centers, and artists. Or architects, so the people who are creative, how they are coming with these ideas and how we can help others to be more creative, because at the end we are creative in a way, and how we can trigger this creativity to come out of ourselves.
Absolutely. I think part of the reason why the creative arts are good, or, you know, excel in creativity, is that it's a sector, it's an industry where creativity is the most valuable asset. So that's how you compete. So you have to really be creative in all your endeavors every day, all the time. You know, you're constantly creating new things. And a second reason is that, you know, in most sectors, it typically suffices to be creative enough to develop solutions that are kind of in the tangent to the norm. This is lingo that we use internally here, but solutions that are perhaps new combinations of existing solutions, right? So it's not radically new, it's just really a new perspective on something that is already known. But for people who are working in the creative industry, you really have to, a lot of the time, think radically new. You really have to kind of push yourself way out of what is normative and what is kind of comfortable. And because you have this habit, you develop a creative skill or a creative capacity that I'm more and more sure translates well across domains. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is that working in the creative industries is a great way to kind of to develop your creative skill. And that creative skill is something that translates across contexts, right? So, you know, an analogy would be being eloquent, so being you know, having a large vocabulary, for instance, being good at public speaking is something that you can take from context to context, or
it's horizontal, we can say. It's not vertical, but it's horizontal in your infrastructure as a person.
You could say that for sure, I think this is something that is becoming more and more evident, that, you know, these people who have these huge creative capacities, really high level creative skills, when facilitated correctly, they can very much be leveraged in contexts and situations way outside their most familiar domain.
Yeah, and they can use for any kind. Like, they have not to be only creative in a specific domain or topic. For instance, I don't know, technology, how to create new interfaces, but they can apply, and I think that's to open the mind, like they can apply this creativity on finance, on arts, on gardening, you know, in different type of areas. So they have to be open, like they are not only creative in one way, but in many different areas and ways.
Exactly. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, in the ISO committee, one of the things that we talked a lot about is innovation management and how innovation management is emerging as a profession. And I'm also starting to think that creativity as a professional skill, at least, if not, as a specific profession, is emerging more and more. And that we're seeing clearer and clearer the importance of having creativity developed as a skill in order to succeed in the workplace.
Yeah, totally. And now, which failure did you learn the most from?
Which failure did I learn the most from? So, another good question.
Yeah, that's the most interesting part.
Wow. So I actually think that, I don't know how much of a failure it is, to be honest. It felt like a failure in some respects. But what comes up really is, in 2012, I was living in Paris and really enjoying my life. I had a wonderful network, a wonderful set of opportunities. I'd just finished my master's degree and I was ready to, you know, to take on the world. And we made a decision at that point to move back to Tromsø, where I grew up, together with my spouse, she was going to participate in a competition, an architecture competition, for some 6 months. And those 6 months became a year, and that year became 2 years. And suddenly I spent 6 years in Tromsø. Now, I just want to say that, you know, before I say what I'm about to say, that there were a lot of aspects about living there that I enjoy thoroughly. It's a great city. It's an amazing city, really, too, especially when you consider where it's located in the world. I just think that what I really did was I changed my circumstance to such a degree that I could no longer kind of pursue the trajectory, if that makes sense, that I wanted. And I think I stayed there way too long. And I guess the what I learned really from that was the impact your circumstance that you are in has on your life, on your priorities, on the way you think, your mental models, the opportunities that you see and the opportunities that you seize. And I really think that, you know, in order to reach your goals, it's not enough to just have, you know, discipline and motivation. You also kind of need to design an environment where it's easy for you to thrive. And, you know, I wanted to pursue creativity and innovation. I wanted to pursue really international agendas, if that makes sense, be it, you know, commercial or otherwise. I wanted to be part of an international community. Moving back to Tromsø didn't take me in that direction. It made it more difficult for me to pursue the things that I wanted. And I think this is something that's probably true for a lot of things. At least that's my experience. I see that, you know, in building around business here, now in Oslo, many of the same principles apply. We have to kind of design circumstances that makes it easy for us to build the business that we want to build, right? We have to make it easy for us to pursue the opportunities that will take our business in the right direction. I think, you know, water or even electricity is a good analogy here. So, you know, if water and the current of electricity will always take the easiest route. So, you know, if you put yourself in a circumstance where what you really want to pursue becomes a more difficult route to choose, you can always say to yourself, well, I just need to motivate myself more, be more disciplined. But you're, you know, over time, you kind of accumulate difficulty by creating circumstances that are that makes it harder for you to excel. And I think this is also something that happens a lot in organizations. We're coming back to the topic of innovation, where we see that organizations, you know, make it difficult to participate in innovation or to take on an innovative perspective or mentality. One very kind of practical and almost silly example is how, you know, the past decade, it's been very popular to create these kind of ID boxes where you can submit an idea to the processor through an email or through a kind of internet.
An idea platform or forum, like you can submit all the ideas.
Exactly. And I think there are many weaknesses to that solution, especially with, you know, the limited level of engagement and continuity. But what I'm trying to get at here is that just, you know, we work with one company where, you know, accessing that idea box would be, you know, some 12 clicks and a password away from the typical kind of digital working environment that employees would be in. And that is just setting up a very difficult circumstance for creating the results that you want. And I think this is one of the main things that I realized, that a lot of the you know, the aspects that I wanted to design for my life, be it in, you know, career wise or personally or whatever, were more difficult for me to find and create in Tromsø than they were in Paris, and that they also are now in Oslo. And it's sometimes difficult to realize, because these are often complex processes, you know, where you have a great variety of contextual variables that influence your ability to pursue the goals that you find to be important. And before you know it, you have this kind of cluster of I don't want to say barriers, but, you know, limitators, if that makes sense, that are acting on you every day and kind of siphoning your energy. Instead of propelling you forward. So, you know, if you want to achieve a goal, you know, design a circumstance that is as conducive as possible to achieving that goal.
This podcast is in collaboration with ISPIM, a community of members from research, industry, consulting, and the public sector. Join Collab With at the 2020 ISPIM Innovation Conference and help Europe's leading innovation management community address today's critical challenges of global importance.
Yeah, I think that's one. I am thinking, because I am taking notes of what you are saying, and a trigger to me is about the attitude. So whatever you are, what you can do with the situation you are in, or with the resources or lack of resources you are, and to get the maximum in a very simple way.
Hmm.
So to reduce the complexity of, like, I like a lot your analogy with the electricity and water with the flow.
Hmm.
This is like, think about water, no? They are always going through the path, the easier the way they have.
You know, if you look at the circumstance you set up for your life personally or for your organization, every time you make one choice easier than the choice that you should be taking in order to, you know, realize your strategy or improve yourself, that is a cost. Right. So it's a cost to, you know, your mental resources, your physical resources, your time. And, you know, we all have finite resources. So, you know, if you have to use discipline and motivation every day to avoid kind of falling into a path that is not leading where you want to go, you're going to run out of that. You're going to run out of discipline. You're going to run out of motivation, and you're going to start doing things that you shouldn't be doing. So it may sound a bit dramatic, but I really think that the essential key to succeeding, both in, you know, your personal career, but also in setting up good processes and cultures for innovation, and also, as you pointed out, Yara, developing the right attitudes, you have to make it easy to make the right choices that are conducive or supporting that development. And I see this very frequently in organizations, that there is this kind of discrepancy between what they say that they want to accomplish with regard to innovation, the organization that they are describing that they want to be in the future, and the steps that they are taking and the way that they are facilitating behaviors in the organization to actually move them toward that end. Right. So innovation becomes something that we do when we have time for it, or when it's comfortable to do it or convenient. It's something that we have in our strategy, but we haven't really made any changes that makes it easy for our employees to prioritize innovative work, right? Okay, so every time an employee wants to do something that has to do with their innovation strategy, they have to make a sacrifice, right? There's a cost to it. It's more difficult to do innovation work than to do other work. Okay, then you're really not facilitating for a development toward a more innovative organization. You've said that you want to do innovation, but you've actually kept it difficult.
Yeah. It's a transaction cost.
Yeah. Yes, you can, like, say that for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you are, Marcos, in a committee. You are a committee member at the work group of the ISO standard for innovation management. How did you start in this work group? And what is your role here? What are your main tasks? So how are you working?
Good question. I guess it started really when I attended a seminar here in Oslo about patents in innovation. And one of the people there was a representative from Standardization Norway, or Standard Norway. And he spoke of this new ISO working group or ISO committee that was trying to write a ISO standard for innovation management systems. And I thought, you know, this sounds very interesting. And he also said that they had a demand for people who had expertise in creativity. And I thought, oh, perfect. And to make things even better, he said the next meeting is in Oslo. So then it was very easy.
Like, it's about the flow, not the electricity and the water.
Right, yeah. Just a perfect current. So that, you know, that just led to me getting invited to participate in the first meeting, just to try it out and see if, you know, is this something that I would want to be contributing to and invest time in. And I got to say, the meeting in Oslo in 2015 really excited me, especially with regard to the work they were trying to do and the potential importance of having a guidance standard for innovation. I really saw it also as a tool to accomplish some of my own goals in terms of, you know, as I said in the beginning, translating or kind of bridging the gap between what we know and what is best practice and what people are doing. You know, I thought maybe if we have this common framework, it will be easier to address, you know, universal questions and problems across organizations. And maybe we can use this as kind of a vessel to get some of the knowledge and the the research and to the methods out of the organizations more effectively. And in terms of the work, you know, the committee is consensus based, so it means that, you know, some dozens of experts from all over the world, some with a standardization background, some with an innovation management background, and some with an academic background, has to come together and agree on terminology, formulation of text, different concepts and principles. And to make things even more complicated, you know, after having agreed on that, you have to get the approval of the countries who are participating in the committee. So, you know, writing this document has taken some over 5 years, and it's, you know, it's probably a multi-billion dollar investment in terms of the number of hours and just cash invested in making this happen. And in terms of my role in this, just to speak to that, because, you know, seeing as it's consensus based, you know, it's up to you how active you want to be and how much you want to contribute. But for me, it's been you know, crucial to contribute as much as possible. And I think, you know, even though Norway, for the most part, has only been an observing member on paper, I have been on serving as kind of an international expert, regardless of that, and contributing a fair bit. And I think what I've found most important is really to bring in the perspectives that we have working so closely with the academic sector, you know, working with leading researchers in the field. And also combining that with practical experience. And in addition to that, one of the things that I saw very clearly early was that we're building a standard again for the commercial sector. You know, we were in the start writing a standard for big corporations, commercial businesses. And of course, the ISO standard certainly has application in that sector and will very likely be valuable for those companies. But I also saw that there was a huge need for a standard like this for the public sector, right? Which is a huge sector in most of Europe and in Scandinavia. And they are, you know, they're dying to learn more about innovation and find better ways to innovate. So, you know, I really tried to fight really for a standard that would ensure, or I fought to ensure, the relevance of the standard for organizations also outside the commercial sector.
Yeah, for instance?
For instance, so an example.
Yes.
So an example would be, in the original drafted text, we spoke a lot about business models.
Yeah.
And, you know, when people use the Osterwalder model, the business model canvas, you typically run into some issues if you're you know, a university hospital or a municipality, or yeah, you know, if you're the Norwegian Refugee Council. So I have repeatedly you know, fought to make sure that we use terminology like a value creation model instead of using a business lingo. And when we use examples like markets and customers, we also want to use terms like clients or beneficiaries or target groups, you know, to make the language universal so that we can use the standard in other sectors as well. And on a more kind of overarching perspective, when we talk about innovation strategy or portfolio management, it's been important for me that when we talk about things like risk assessment or value goals, value objectives in a portfolio setting, that we include value that is not necessarily commercial, and that we emphasize that so that organizations that don't necessarily have a commercial mission at the heart of their strategy also can read the standard and, you know, nod with recognition and say, yes, this is useful for us. This speaks to us. This speaks to the problems that we're facing. This can help.
Yeah. This is, I'm thinking now, because that is very important. When everything seems to be tailor-made for corporates, They are sometimes we cannot apply this is all the methodologies or some questions or some apps or platforms, they are tailored for corporates. Then the SMEs, so the small companies, or the startup, they say, yeah, and us, how?
Yeah.
And mainly they are most of the time left out. Not like you have a very good point on vocabulary and wording. It's a very good point to, we can say, to remove the bias on the corporate language.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think you also bring up a good point here, Yara, about small and SMEs, small and medium enterprises. And that's actually a big chunk of our work has gone into taking, you know, insights from the standard and from research and adapting that to an SME setting. Because, you know, sure, if you're a big corporation or even if you're a, you know, a municipality or a ministry, you can speak in portfolio lingo, right? You can say that, okay, we have about 25 projects and we manage risk across those 25 projects with regard to return. But if you're a startup or if you're an SME, you may not afford to have a portfolio. Maybe you just have the one innovation project, right? Or maybe you have three, but if one of them fails miserably, may put you out of business, right? So, you're in a different situation, and you have to kind of take these overarching ideas on a principle level, and you have to kind of give them a new expression that fits with your SME reality. And we put quite a bit of work into developing tools, methods that are tailored to that setting, so that you can, you know, kind of use the same perspective, the same mental models that are expressed in these tools, methodologies, research around big corporations, and apply them to a small business setting.
Yeah, yeah, very good.
Very, very interesting work, because what we see very clearly is that some of these principles very much hold true across size, across organizational design, across, you know, sectors, be it private, public, and so on.
And it's a point like to go into the minimal individual point. I'm thinking now on, you know, Jostein Gaarder has a book, so from Norway.
Yes.
Has a book about, I don't remember the name, but has a book about the Lego pieces. No, if you are going to more to the individual, to the core, you can, and you have the simplicity and a scarcity of resources. Then you can build something is cross everyone. It's the building blocks like anyone can use. Because in big corporates you have teams as well. And you have people, how they can use these methodologies or this way of working and how they can be more creative when they are only one or two people.
Right.
And then scale up from there.
I think that's so important, and it kind of it kind of links with something I've been thinking a lot about lately, which is it's really two things. It's the connection of these kind of principles for creativity and innovation across scale. You know, so what are some of the universal principles for creativity that are true whether you're going through a, you know, maybe you're composing a piece individually for piano and you're just working alone. Or you are working creatively to solve a major challenge in a company of 4,000 employees. The principle is the same, but it's expressed differently. Right? So what are the key principles? The other thing I'm thinking about is, you know, how can we engage individuals in a kind of innovative mindset that holds true. Let me start that again. It's really a shift from having a process mentality or a process approach to innovation to having more of a mindset or a perspective approach to innovation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really think that I'm thinking more and more of innovation as a mindset, almost like a philosophy about entering into the unknown, accepting uncertainty, and, you know, being able to create value despite being in these kind of shifting, volatile conditions. Because, you know, when we look at the innovation process And when we look at the scaling process and when we look at the creative process, we see that many of these mindsets and perspectives, they recur, right? So it's the same perspectives, really, that you need to come up with good ideas, that you need to come up with good models for scaling or good implementation strategies, right? So it's really the same sort of sets of skills, even though the process might be different. So I'm thinking about, you know, can we take these principles and these mindsets and create kind of universal models for how we approach creativity and innovation? And how can we, if they hold true across the process and across different, you know, sizes and contexts, how can we strengthen them? You know, how can we make sure that organizations, but also individuals, develop these principles, mindsets, skills, to have more, you know, to experience more success in their creative endeavors.
You are listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast, a production from Collab With and the NoCo community. We are an online community helping businesses connect with experts to solve innovation challenges and create consortiums. We do this through a custom-built environment where academics, startups, and businesses collaborate to innovate and accelerate. Together, we break down the barrier between academics and the business world. Innovation has never been so accessible. And now, back to our podcast.
So you mentioned about consensus in your working group.
Yes.
So what is innovation for you?
So that I almost feel like I kind of started answering that question. Because
yes, that's true with the mindset. Yes.
Yeah. I think, I mean, the traditionally, and you know, in the ISO committee, we talk about innovation mostly as a result, you know, that is new and valuable, but we also talk about it as a process. And as I said before, I'm increasingly interested in thinking more about it as kind of various components of a mindset that you apply in, you know, in slightly different configurations to create new value. In these circumstances where there is uncertainty. I think that's a helpful way to think about it, because when you talk about novelty and when you talk about value, those are very relative concepts, right? So what is new in one context may be completely obsolete in another context, and what is valuable to some is hurtful to others. So you kind of end up in this relativist discussion where you can constantly move back and forth about what is valuable and what is new, and suddenly you're speaking more about philosophy than of innovation. Mm-hmm. But if we can talk about perspectives and behaviors and almost modes or scripts or heuristics, or I'm still searching for the right word here, but if we can start talking about kind of mental models for what innovation is and seeing it more as kind of a behavior or as a worldview than just a process and just a result, I think that would be a helpful addition to understanding what innovation is.
Yeah, and maybe as well driving innovation through the teams and the companies. I'm thinking, like, if it's only a mindset, then you go to change the mindset of, which is already complicated, and the culture, and already you have more creative and innovative people, and then they end up doing different things, like that's the goal, and I have maybe a better and huge impact, like we have to follow that. I did this step, I missed a step, you know, like
I think you're right. I think I mean, obviously you need both. If you have mindsets but no structure, you're gonna have a fun time, but I'm not sure you're going to innovate that much. Well, it certainly depends how much structure you need, but I think you're right in that, you know, if you only have the process, what tends to happen is that you tick boxes, right? So you move through the process and you make sure that you do everything you need to do. But every step of the way, every process that you do, every activity that you do is going to lack something unless you have that mindset, unless you have those, you know, the skills, the methods, the approach in place. And what we try to encourage our clients to do is to use innovation projects and activities to both develop, you know, innovative solutions, but also to develop perspectives, develop competency, and start kind of building a brand for innovation internally in the organization that has a meaning to the employees and that they want to be associated with.
Yeah. So you were at ISPIN conference in Florence, co-working with attendees, getting feedback from academics and practitioners on the ISO standard for innovation management. Mm. So what is the next steps from this co-working and co-creation activities?
There are many next steps. in terms of the standard itself, it is due for publication this fall, probably in August or September. It was ratified by the participating countries, so it's all clear for publication, which is good. But I think a large part of the work still remains. I mean, you also participated in some of the sessions in ISPIM about the standard, and you know the feedback is naturally mixed. I mean, some very few see no point in this at all. Why standardize innovation? And about as many are completely certain that this will certainly work. This is great. We need a standard for innovation.
Yeah, I think we need urgently a standard for innovation.
I think so too. But still, what I think we need to keep in mind is that the standard is something of an experiment. So you know, it's kind of like we've spent 5 years developing a solution without really testing it that much. You know, and what we need now is to validate the standard. We need to try it out, right? We need to start working with companies and organizations to see, you know, what happens if we integrate some of the ideas and some of the methods and guidance really from the standard in an organization. Does it achieve the goal of building more innovative organizations, getting more output from your innovation investments? Or does it really not make that much of a difference? I mean, I feel pretty confident that it's going to have an impact. And to be fair, we have already started here in Tinker to integrate many of the ideas from the standard in our practice. And, you know, as such, we kind of have started the validation process now, even prior to the completion and the recent ratification of the standard. But what is going to happen is that, you know, we have initiated or accepted a number of international collaborations with organizations both in Europe and in the Americas and in Asia to start implementing the standard and also doing research on the implementation of the standard to both validate it, but perhaps more importantly, refine it. You know, one of the most important aspects of the standard in a quote unquote market setting, you know, what is most in demand? People really need guidance on building a creative climate or on portfolio management or setting up an innovation process or collaborating with other organizations. You know, what is it that is most in demand? And how can the guidance best be used for them?
Yeah. So now we have some extra questions to know you better as a person.
Okay.
What is your favorite music?
My favorite music? So, I haven't mentioned this, but I almost became a jazz musician. I was accepted into higher education after high school, but got cold feet. So jazz music has been very important for me. It was back then, and it has continued to be, both because I really enjoy the music, but also because I love this improvisational aspect. Right. And I think actually improvisation is a great analogy for many of the things that we've talked about today in terms of but on the other hand, I also really appreciate classical music, you know, the grandstanding and timeless works of like Rachmaninoff and Beethoven. And I think, you know, it's really a matter of mood or mindset, I guess. You know, sometimes you want to kind of throw things up in the air and experiment, and I really like some of the, you know, ECM music or ECM published jazz music with Keith Jarrett and Garbarek and so on. But I also enjoy listening to more contemplative music. And I think that kind of also illustrate both me as a person and innovation or creativity, you know, these contrasts between the radically explorative and the more contemplative approach. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if you have to recommend a book, which book you would like to recommend?
Just one, huh?
I
think, I mean, the book that is most important for me right now is actually Meditations by Marcus Aurelius.
Oh.
And Marcus Aurelius, as you and probably many of your listeners know, was a Roman emperor, and he has, you know, the book Meditations, I think, is really just a compilation of a lot of the texts that he probably wrote just for himself, more so than for publication. But it's really one of the cornerstones of Stoic philosophy, and it has tremendous value, I think, for people today as well. Just, you know, the lessons are really universal with regard to how to approach your life, how to interpret your life, and how to, you know, how to lead a life with grace and peace. And I think it's really something everyone should read. I mean, if it was up to me, it should be in every hotel. You know, in every hotel in the drawer, you should find Marcus Aurelius.
I'm thinking now, like this one, like the peaceful is you are feeling peace when you are in the right path.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you discuss early on,
right,
the fluidity of electricity and water,
mm-hmm,
and the right path and the simple path. So I think this is the point.
No, certainly, I think so too. But to add to that, I think what Stoicism really helps with is that, you know, you're not going to be on the right path forever. You know, actually, I think it's more true that you're on the right path for glimpses of time in your life, and you just recognize, oh, this is perfect, this is right, conditions mm-hmm right now are really good.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the times, you're just kind of fumbling around in the fog. You know, you don't know where you're going, and you don't know if you're in the right place. And I think what Stoicism and what these meditations really help with is accepting that and finding a way to kind of be peaceful and graceful and content, even in struggle, even in confusion. Again, it's tempting to draw a line back to what we were talking about with creativity, that, you know, working in processes of uncertainty, having this kind of resilience and this,
mm-hmm,
this ability to accept uncertainty and discomfort is just extremely valuable.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. So the last question, are you listening to podcasts?
Oh, absolutely, I am.
So do you have some favorite podcast you can recommend or you are listening?
Sure. So I listen a lot to Making Sense with Sam Harris. I think that's hugely fascinating, covering a great variety of topics from, you know, politics to technology, religion and philosophy, and also consciousness. So that's a really good one. For innovation, I think that Masters of Scale is really good. It's a podcast by the founder of LinkedIn. His name eludes me right now. Reid Hoffman. That's a really good one. A third one would probably be Hardcore History with Dan Carlin. I think, maybe it's just an effect of getting older, but I feel like history has many lessons to teach us. And what Dan Carlin does is he has these really long format podcasts where he talks about or really studies historical events in depth. You know, the episodes are hours long and hugely fascinating and extremely thorough. So if you're a history buff and, as me, recognize the value of history for tackling modern challenges, he is a very important very stimulating man to listen to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Marcos, thank you very much for this podcast.
Of course.
Was always amazing to talk to you. I think we can have here hours and hours, because I have some points as well to discuss offline with you.
Perfect. So let's continue this discussion offline, then, Yara, and invite me back whenever you want. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review over on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. You can find a summary of this podcast at podcast.collabweb.org. See you next week.